You're listening to the Hog Sports Network Daily Podcast. Now, here's your host, Matt Jones.
And good Friday morning to you. We appreciate you being here. Matt Jones with Christina Long in Fayetteville. The Razorbacks, they go through their first scrimmage of the preseason on Thursday. It was closed. We didn't get to see it, but we heard quite a bit about it. They are now 20 days from the start of the season, kickoff August 29th against UAPB down at War Memorial Stadium in Little Rock. We talked to Sam Pittman after the scrimmage yesterday, Christina. A lot of words were said on his part. There were a lot of players who were out. So, you know, I mean, I think maybe you kind of take with a grain of salt anything you don't see with your own eyes, I think, first of all. But then also, I think, you know, maybe some of the players who had big days, you kind of have to compare that to who was not out there. So, you know, just with that in mind, what were some of your takeaways?
Right. It's like the performance has almost come a little bit with an asterisk because it's not the team that they're going to run out there on August 29th. So, you know, there were 15 guys that missed the scrimmage yesterday. He said none of them are expected to be severe. They don't expect them to be long-term injuries. Nobody's done for the season, as far as they can tell. A few concussions, guys that should be back before practice is done. He didn't indicate anybody that he thinks will miss game one. So that's a positive for them for sure. And he did say, you know, if this were a game week and we needed some of these guys to play, they would have been able to. But there's no sense pushing that with these kind of minor injuries. So as far as takeaways, I mean, he said he had a lot to say about running back Braylon Russell. Jaquindon Jackson missed yesterday. They held him out. He's been in practice, seems to be minor, but they held him out of the scrimmage. And it seemed like Braylon Russell had a really, really good scrimmage. They got to get a look at some of their other receivers besides Andrew Armstrong and Tyrone Broden, who both were held out. Ethan Westerman wrote a story yesterday about that, about the other receivers that stepped up. And that was something that was really important because I think when I was here the other day, we talked a little bit about how the question of what they have behind Broden, Armstrong, and Satania is a concern. You know, it's just in terms of we don't really know what they have in those guys. And so some of those guys got a little bit more work. Taylen Green shouted out Davion Dozier as somebody who performed really well. They really liked how Monte Harrison performed. I mean, I still don't know what to expect as far as how much he will see the field on the offense. He's the former MLB player that they added in the offseason. And so I don't know what to expect from him once the season begins, but it has been fun and interesting to see him in practice and to see that he's kind of picked it up pretty well despite not playing football since high school. So they were really impressed with him too.
And Pittman mentioned this. He said that the offense played better early. Basically, what he said was the defense has to start better, and the offense has to finish better. And so it kind of sounds like one of those deals where, you know, each kind of one half a day. I don't know if that's the case or not. Based on, you know, some firsthand accounts from other people that were there, they said the offense was really good early and had a lot of big plays, and we heard that too. You know, we kind of had a readout of different you know, big plays that were in the scrimmage. Apparently the first two plays were a 45-yard pass to Isaiah Satania and then a 65-yard touchdown pass to Isaiah Satania. And I saw a video clip of the Satania touchdown catch, and I'm always curious about these long passes. You know, is it a long pass or is it kind of a short pass and then it's a long run?
A catch and run, yeah.
And it was kind of a combination of the two on the 65-yarder. He caught it somewhere around the 40-yard line, so 25, 30 yards downfield from where the ball was thrown, and then outran the defense for 40 yards.
Yeah, and was that the one where he no, that was from the other day when he beat Jalen Braxton. But they've had some interesting battles in practice too. But yeah, I mean, it's hard when you don't get to see it yourself, and you kind of, you know, we're all kind of waiting on those social media clips that we see from them on those closed scrimmages. But yeah, I mean, one thing I think that stood out to me,
very sanitized social media.
Yeah,
clips, I would
very
add.
True, very true.
You don't see the pick sixes.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, when we're in practice and we're taking video, it's like, there's a drop. You know, that happens. You know, that happens everywhere. But one thing that stood out to me was the kicking game and what he said about that. Because in spring, the kicking was a problem. It was not consistent. And all through the offseason, we kept hearing Pittman and special teams coordinator Scott Fountain talk about how It's just when they were in the stadium. You know, mm-hmm. they've done great in some of the stuff that's not live, you know, practice field, indoor. But when they get in scrimmage situations in the stadium, they were having trouble. And Fountain, you know, said there's something to do with the way the stadium is built, something about the tunnels. There's like a wind situation.
I can attest to that.
Yeah. But it's but at the same time, it's like, all right, well, when you play, you're kicking in the stadium.
No,
so
you've
got to figure it out. And so that led them to go to the portal and get Kyle Ramsey from Abilene Christian, mm-hmm. FCS All-American, really great numbers. And Matthew Shipley, the transfer they had in the spring, who was one of the ones that struggled, he also had great numbers last season at Hawaii. And so it seems like after yesterday, Pittman felt a lot better about Shipley. I think he went 3 for 4. He had a make from 51 that they mm-hmm. said was what they would consider, you know, a game winner in the 2 minute for the offense. And so it seems like he showed a lot of improvement. They feel really good about that. I would say it's probably I would predict that he's probably going to have the job. It's hard to know because Ramsey is so good and mm-hmm. is pushing him. But I think they want to see Shipley make that happen.
Kicker is just one of those things you just never know.
Yeah.
You never, like Dan Bailey, the Cowboys great kicker for all those years. You know, he was actually committed to Arkansas at one point, and then he never made it here. Somehow ended up over at Oklahoma State. I think he played six-man football in Oklahoma, and he taught himself to kick by, like, duct taping some PVC pipes together in his backyard. You know what I mean? You think about all these guys. Jake Bates is a great
yeah.
example. I don't know if he'll make the Lions roster or not, but he seems like he's in a decent position to do it, and he's done it by coming through the UFL. You can go on and on. Brandon Aubrey was the best kicker in the NFL last year, Cowboys rookie, and he came out of the USFL. And I say all that to say that, you know, Shipley, he's got the credentials because two times at Hawaii, he was a Groza Award semifinalist, including last year. He had a pretty good year last year. One of the best plays of the year, I wrote about this when he committed to Arkansas, was they were playing, I think maybe Colorado State in the last game of the year. And they ran a total, you know, emergency drill field goal, and the guy sprints like 40 yards to the spot with less than 10 seconds, and the clock is ticking, and he drills a 50-something yarder to win the game. So, you know, there's a little bit of I don't know if clutch gene is the, but you know, I mean, he's performed
yeah.
well in games. Well, it'll be interesting. Certain stadiums are tough to kick in, like in the NFL, Pittsburgh is notorious for being. Mm-hmm. like the toughest stadium to kick in. I know the ACC kickers, they have to kick there too mm-hmm. because where the Pitt Panthers play. It'd be interesting to look at like a field goal breakdown of maybe Razorback Stadium versus other stadiums
yeah.
in the
That'd
SEC
be a good
and
question.
See if there is
yeah.
something there too. That Satania was, I mean, we just keep waiting for him to break out and have a big season. And, you know, Ethan and I talked about this the other day. We thought he was going to have one last year, and it didn't work out for whatever reason. They seem to really like him.
Yeah.
And he had a big day yesterday.
Right. I think just with the situation they have, I mean, he's your prototypical slot receiver. And I think that with the situation they have in the slot, I mean, this is like he has the opportunity. Like he can go and seize that moment. It's just kind of up to him, I feel like. And, you know, obviously you want to factor in health. You know, you need to factor in the quarterback performance, things like that. So I do think he has a really great opportunity. And I know we talked the other day about Petrino talking about how, hey, he could have some Joe Adams in him and as far as being a returner and a receiver. And, you know, Joe Adams, that's a lot to live up to. And I don't think anybody will expect him to duplicate that necessarily, you know, exactly. But I think, yeah, he has a great opportunity. And you know, it's been that way before, but we'll see what happens. I think he'll definitely be somebody to watch. It'll be interesting.
I wanted to go back a second to the offense having a good start to the scrimmage, because the offense did not start games well last season. You know, I looked this up back in the offseason. I got some numbers right here. They did not score a touchdown in 5 of their 8 SEC games in the first half.
Wow.
They were really bad in the first half. And, you know, you kind of think about some of these games where they were close. Alabama, they had a couple of touchdown drives in the second half. Ole Miss, same thing. I think they scored a touchdown in the first half of Ole Miss, and then they scored the rest of their points after halftime. Not that there were, you know, a whole lot of points scored in that game. LSU, they were really good after halftime. They weren't bad in the first half against LSU. That was probably one of their best first halves. Florida, the game that they won last year after halftime, was when they played best offensively. But, you know, last year, just looking at some numbers here, in the first half of SEC games, Arkansas averaged 119 yards, and that is really bad. That's a really bad number. Not that 165 yards are any better, but that was their second half number. So in the second half, you know, roughly 50 more yards they had in the second half. And I don't think that's really that surprising. You see this a lot in football that, you know, defenses wear down and you have to, you typically have a lot more offensive success in the second half. But the 119 yards before halftime in SEC play, and the fact they didn't score a touchdown in five of their eight SEC games last year in the first half, those are numbers that are going to have to get better. So the fact that they had some offensive success early in this scrimmage, albeit against themselves, I think that might be a good sign.
Yeah, and Pittman talked a lot about that in the spring. Just when he kind of debriefed on last season with the benefit of hindsight, he talked a lot about how they needed to be able to finish games. And we talked about, you know, a lot of that was starting from when you start that far behind, mm-hmm. it's hard to finish. It's hard to pull off a comeback like that time and time again. And that's mm-hmm. when you see them lose so many close games. And so that's something that's front of mind for them. They know that it was a problem. They are going to try to make it better. It's hard though, because yeah, you have to start better, but you do also have to have the ability to finish those games. And that was what he talked about with the defense, was the defense maybe didn't finish so well. So it'll be interesting to see what happens when they're actually playing a team other than themselves.
We've got Jay Black from the Southwest Conference Hall of Fame. He's coming up. We're going to talk to him about the Southwest Conference Hall of Fame induction that's coming up next week. Oliver Miller will be inducted representing Arkansas. You can get our latest news at wholehogsports.com. We think it's the most in-depth source for all Arkansas sports. Great team of reporters, photographers on all the Razorback sports. It's not just football. We've got, just this week, we've had baseball stories and soccer stories, and obviously lots of track stories coming out of the Olympics, and I could go on and on. Volleyball. Paul Boyd wrote a volleyball preview yesterday as they were starting their preseason camp. You can subscribe today at wholehogsports.com. Christina, I wanted to talk to you about this earlier in the week, and we didn't get to it. Something, an item earlier this week that caught my eye was that the College Football Network put out some predictions for the season, and they said that they thought the defensive transfer of the year in college football, not just the SEC but the entire nation, would be Anton Junkaj, the defensive end who transferred to Arkansas from the University of Albany. Albany was a good team last year. I think they were in the FCS semifinals. I think Junkaj had 15 sacks on that team, and I know there's some excitement about him and you know, potentially finding a diamond in the rough, similar to what they've done with, you know, some players the last couple of years, like Andrew Armstrong, came from Division II. Junkaj, he hasn't been in practice a whole lot.
Yeah.
You did see him some in the spring. What are your thoughts on him? And when you hear somebody make that's a pretty bold proclamation that they think that this guy could be the defensive transfer of the year. It doesn't really have any bearing, but it's still kind of interesting to talk about.
Yeah, it feels like a bold take. I mean, I guess I'd have to look at who all the other, you know, defensive transfers are and see where I felt like he stacked up.
Well, you got
up.
Caleb Downs going to Ohio State. That's a pretty big one.
Yeah, so I mean, that is extremely high praise for a guy that they think of as their third defensive end. Behind Nico Davie, he'll be kind of the new starter alongside Landon Jackson there, is the presumption. That's what's been happening all through practice. He's been out for a few weeks. They expect to get him back before too long. But, I mean, he's really impressive. He has those numbers from FCS, and I want to say this is his last year of eligibility. And so I feel like sometimes when you see those guys come up from, you know, the lower levels, they take a little bit to adjust. Some of them take a year. You know, Armstrong mm-hmm. had a good year where he's poised to take on a bigger role, to have a better year. We've talked a lot with some of those guys this season about, like, okay, now that you've got a year in the SEC, now what happens? And so it's a lot for Junkaj to make that jump quickly, even if it's not his last year of eligibility. Even if he does have another year, it is a lot of – that's a lot of pressure to put on him. But mm-hmm. also, I mean, I do think he could live up to it. I remember we talked to Landon Jackson in the spring about impressions of him, and we used Armstrong, you know, we were talking to Jackson and Armstrong together, and we used Armstrong as the example. We were like, you know, he came up from he was from Texas A&M Commerce, wasn't mm-hmm. he? And so he came up from that, you know, lower level and, you know, came out and had a good season. Just what was the adjustment like? And Jackson was like, if you can play, he was like, he had 15 sacks. If you have 15 sacks at any level, like, you're good, you know, like, you're good. You can do it. You've played it, you've done it, whatever. And so Junkaj is interesting too, because he went to Albany from JUCO, I think. So he's kind of risen up slowly but steadily. And so, I mean, I'm definitely interested to watch him. I'm interested to see how they use him. They feel good about him. They aren't sure what they have as far as a fourth D end, but they feel confident in Junkaj as that third guy.
I've got some thought, just some random thoughts here. I know FCS is not junior college, but I talked to a coach one time a lot of years ago, and he said with a junior college player, when they transfer in, you don't expect much of them for the first half of the season. You hope that you can get a lot out of them in the second half of the season, and then you really hope that they've got 2 years of eligibility because you could get a lot out of them that second year once they've really acclimated to it. FCS is better than junior college, and I say that knowing that full well. I think FCS has gotten better in the last 4 or 5 years because of the age of the FBS. You know, I mean, players can stay in college longer, and so that's forcing more players down to lower levels, and FCS seems to be catching more of them. I think about Missouri State when they came here 2 years ago with Petrino. You look at that roster, they had a lot of transfers who had come from FBS, not just FBS rosters, but from, at the time, Power 5 conferences. I remember they had from Utah. They had, and I can't remember all the places, but I remember thinking at that time, it's like, this is a large number of players that are coming from Power 5 schools, and so there's a little bit of a trickle-down effect. What's happening is players, they get into the transfer portal, and then there's no room at the end at other FBS programs, or maybe FBS programs that they want to end up at. You know, they might be able to go to a Toledo or a San Jose State or something, and they don't want to do that. Maybe they want to stay closer to home, and they end up at an FCS program closer to home. So one other thought. I was talking to Dave Van Horn a couple of years ago about some of these players who come up from programs where, you know, they're not so glamorous. It's not so glitzy. I think this was after Michael Turner had come in from Kent State.
Yeah.
And he said that, you know, when they are in that type of program and then they come into a place that has so much more support and resources that it just brings the best out of them. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain, I don't know, maybe want to out of them. You know what I mean? And anyway, all of this is to say maybe June Kaj is kind of a diamond in the rough. And like we said, we've seen this a couple of times in the last few years with players at Arkansas, with Armstrong being the most recent.
Yeah, and I mean, when you look at the Albany program, you mentioned they were an FCS playoff
team.
They
were a very good team.
And Jared Verse from Florida State was an Albany guy, you know, and he was a high draft pick. You know, he was an impressive guy, had a great career at Florida State, and he was an Albany guy.
Sailor Poffenberger's brother was the quarterback at Albany, and he transferred to
I was gonna say pop
Miami?
Quiz, do you know where?
It
might be Miami.
I think it might be Miami. Right. I mean, he was an All-America type quarterback there, and I know that there was some interest in him when he got into the transfer portal. Patrick Kutis was out again yesterday, and we finally got an update on him that he's dealing with a back injury.
Yeah, and that had been rumored, but yeah, Pittman confirmed that it was a back injury, and you know, they seem to think, he said maybe a week and a half before they get him back. I mean, it is a concern because, you know, anytime you have an offensive lineman with a back issue, it's concerning, but they seem to think it's going to be fine. They've been working Amari Wiggins in at center and then moving Addison Nichols over to the left guard and kind of trading those two around. Mm-hmm. And so that seems to be the backup plan if they were to lose Kutis during the season.
This time last year, I think they were dealing with Brady Latham out. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember exactly. I don't know if it was maybe been some concussion issues with him. And that's not to say that their offensive line would have been a whole lot better because they didn't play well all season. But we saw some offense. Obviously, we saw offensive line problems early in the year, and you know, you wonder, and when Latham came back, there was some talk about, you know, how long would it take him to the offensive line is one of those deals where cohesion is such a big deal. You know, I mean, it's one player can make a huge difference, but you know, when you've got all these players playing together, it's interesting to see what's going to happen with Kutis and the line and how soon he can get back, because you know, you think like to Oklahoma State, you really want to have an offensive line that's clicking on all cylinders, but you got to have them playing together for a couple of weeks, I think at least, in the preseason to be able to accomplish that.
Right. It'll be interesting, too, since they've built this line a lot out of the transfer portal. And I've heard some people talk about how, you know, people that know more about offensive line than I do just talk about how sometimes that can be a challenge in itself because of that. Now, I asked Pittman about that over the summer. I was like, are you concerned? You know, I've heard people say that building a line out of the portal can have mixed results because of that, you know, the chemistry aspect, just the style of play, things like that, needing enough time to adjust. And he was like, I'm not worried about it. That's not a thing. So I don't know.
Kurt Anderson, who was the offensive line coach here under Bielema for the last couple of years, he replaced Pittman as the line coach. He had one of the great quotes when it came to just the timing and rhythm and sync that a line needs to be in. He said, I want my alignment kicking like the Rockettes. He said, I want that line to look like a Rockette line, that all the steps are the same and they're in the same. Just kind of interesting. they need to get Kudus back, obviously, as soon as they can to get all that timing in sync. Christina, we appreciate you being here. Jay Black of the Southwest Conference Hall of Fame will be up in just a moment. But first, a word from Kendall.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over four decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design, with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are design.
And welcome back in. We appreciate you being here on this beautiful Friday morning. Our podcast is brought to you in part by Bentonville Glass, committed, professional, versatile, serving its community since 1971. If you're looking for a quality leader in Northwest Arkansas or looking for skilled craftsmanship, you can choose Bentonville Glass. All your glass market needs with the highest quality products. Come by and see them at 507 South Main in Bentonville or online at bentonvilleglass.com. We're joined now by Jay Black. Jay is the curator for the Texas Sports Hall of Fame in Waco. And within the Texas Sports Hall of Fame is the Southwest Conference Hall of Fame, and that's relative, or it's timely to what we're talking about right now, because next week, I believe it's on Tuesday, they will induct a new class of members to the Southwest Conference Hall of Fame. Oliver Miller, the Razorback basketball great under Nolan Richardson, will represent Arkansas. There is an athlete from each school that is inducted each year, and so there will be nine new members that are inducted next week. Jay, we appreciate you being here.
Hey, Matt, thanks for having me on.
You know, so 3 years ago, I was in Waco. My wife dragged me down there to see the silos, as I'm sure a lot of people
that'll happen a lot of times. That'll sure happen around here.
But, you know, I came in and you and I met there at the museum, and I'd always been intrigued by the Southwest Conference Hall of Fame because, you know, we've written for a number of years. There was a catch-up process to get a number of Razorbacks into the Southwest Conference Hall of Fame, and we can talk about why that was here in just a moment. But I was really taken aback, Jay, by just how well the museum was kept. Number one, not that I've been to a lot of state sports Hall of Fames, but I can't imagine there are a lot better than what you have there in Waco. It's a really great museum. And then the Southwest Conference Hall of Fame wing, it's really well done. Tell people who haven't been there just exactly what that museum looks like and kind of how it came about.
Well, thank you. We appreciate the kind words. So the unique thing about the Southwest Conference Gallery, and it's about 5,000 to 6,000 square feet, is that in my mind, and if I'm incorrect, somebody correct me, but I think I'm right, that the Southwest Conference, although it's no longer with us, is the only athletic conference to have its own permanent museum, and that's what we have here in Waco. We have an area for each of the nine primary schools in the conference, Arkansas included, of course, which was a longtime member, I think dating back to like 1914 up through 1991. But there's six or seven cases in each of the school's areas, including a mascot case, which is really popular. And, you know, we tried to focus on what sports the school was good at. So, you know, for Arkansas, of course, we have two cases for football, two for basketball, track field, cross country, and a baseball exhibit case.
Where do these items come from?
Primarily, some of the schools have smaller museums and they've been collecting things, or their Letterman's Association. But a lot of times it'll just be people off the street that say, hey, you know, my grandfather or my uncle was in the conference and I've got this, you name it, helmet, football, letter sweater, poster. Would you guys like to display it? And a lot of times the answer is yes.
You know, I was thinking about this the other day. Like you mentioned, there were nine primary teams in the Southwest Conference. By my count, Jay, six of those nine have changed conferences again at least one time since they left the Southwest Conference, the latest obviously being Texas going to the SEC this year. It seems like now more than ever is a great time to have this Hall of Fame to remember a conference that very rapidly, I feel like, is kind of eroding from the memory.
Right. So, you know, the last football season for the Southwest Conference was 1995, and then the spring sports bled over into 1996. So, you know, I'm not great at math, but that's almost three decades, 30 years ago. So you're right. I don't know that we're going to have this banquet forever. You know, it's kind of winding down. The people that participated in the 80s are getting older. And an interesting fact about the class that we're going to enshrine next Tuesday, and I just noticed this morning, but all eight of the nine participated in the 1980s, except for Tony Franklin, who kicked for Texas A&M in the 1970s. So it wasn't set up that way specifically, but that's just kind of how it turned out.
How are new Hall of Fame members decided upon? And I guess maybe, you know, what's number one, what kind of committee do you have in place to come up with new names? And then just kind of what is that process like?
Right. So each of the nine schools has a committee chairman, and sometimes it's a small committee of two or three. Sometimes it can be as many as six or seven. But and it's not necessarily from the university, although in the example for Arkansas, the well-esteemed great Kevin Traynor, the longtime used to be called sports information directors, but now they have communications or PR specialists for the
athletic department. They got about 10 words in their title.
He is our go-to guy in Arkansas. And so, you know, we will get nominations from the public and we'll forward those to Kevin. And then, you know, of course, he doesn't need a lot of help in determining who the key figures in Arkansas athletic history are. But, you know, I think he does some work for the A club up there. So, So it's kind of a semi-autonomous group based on who's in the know for each of the former Southwest Conference schools.
The SWC Hall is about 10 years old, maybe a little older.
Right. So I think we finished construction on we basically doubled the size of the museum, and that was where we included the Southwest Conference gallery. So that opened about 2010, I think. And our very first Southwest Conference Hall of Fame banquet was in 2013.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the way I understand it is that anyone who was in the Texas Sports Hall of Fame at the time that you opened the SWC Hall was basically grandfathered in if they had any type of affiliation with the conference. Is that correct?
Right, right. So, you know, like someone like Doak Walker at SMU or Sammy Baugh at TCU, they had been inducted in the Texas Sports Hall of Fame for years. And so we really didn't want to go over that ground again and have banquets because, you know, honestly, a lot of those folks are deceased. And it just made sense to allow schools like Arkansas, because if you think about it, the Texas Sports Hall of Fame, there were only a couple like Jimmy Johnson and Jerry Jones who were in through their merits of what they contributed to Texas sports. So we allowed some schools like in Arkansas took great advantage of this to have their own banquet where they would induct eight or nine members. Because if we only allow schools to induct one person a year, they're never going to catch up with all the great players that have gone through in Arkansas history in all sports, football, basketball, track and field. So, you know, it's kind of interesting. Arkansas now has, more members in the Southwest Conference Hall of Fame than any other of the Texas schools. There's 74 members when Oliver Miller will be inducted next Tuesday.
That's pretty crazy. You mentioned that, you know, you don't know how long this can go on just because, you know, the conference did have an endpoint. How many more years do you think you might be inducting new members into the Southwest Hall?
Oh, I mean, I don't think it's imminent, but I mean, I can see at some point, I don't know, maybe we probably have another good 10 years, I hope.
Okay.
I mean, I really enjoy it. I mean, it's kind of fun to get all the schools back together. You know, a lot of the people from the athletic departments that come know each other, so they have fun visiting and telling old stories. And, you know, on a good day for one of our banquets, the athletes and the coaches will kind of tease each other and the schools and rehash the old rivalries. And it's really about stories. And whenever we can mine those stories, we're really hitting pay dirt on what our mission is here at the museum.
You know, one part that's not part of the Southwest Conference Hall of Fame exhibit within your building there, but obviously you can see, if you go in to see the SWC Hall, you've got a library there with all of Dave Campbell's, or a lot of Dave Campbell's books and memorabilia. Of course, he worked there in Waco for all of those years, and I think anyone who was in the Southwest Conference has a little bit of an affinity and affection for Dave Campbell, because the Dave Campbell magazine is still printed in Texas. But for a lot of years, there was a Dave Campbell's magazine here in Arkansas, too. That's a really neat part of your building.
Right, right. And we mentioned and have some examples of Dave Campbell's Arkansas football in the Texas High School Football Hall of Fame exhibit, which has a whole wall dedicated to the history of his magazine. And, you know, there's a story that went around that one day God came down, put his arm around Dave Campbell and said, Dave, you and I should write a book, or we should each write a book. You cover football and I'll cover everything else. I think Arkansas football, the first issue probably came out around 1963, and I think it went up into the 90s.
I
had never lived in Arkansas, but I can tell you, in Central Texas and throughout our big state down here, it was people eagerly awaited the magazine coming out.
And they still do. You know, they still do, right?
Oh, yeah. It's still being published. You know, a lot of it's moving to online and digital media formats, but I think as long as they're still in business, they're going to print hard copies of the magazine. And when Mr. Campbell was alive, every year he would make a point of coming down and doing signings in person. We would literally have people waiting outside the door to get their first issue, to see who was picked to win what high school district, or who was going to win the conference championship, who was predicted. And it's funny, it's such a vast enterprise. It took, you know, tens and twenties of people to put the magazine together, but people would come and ask, do you really think De Leon's going to beat Comanche this year, Mr. Campbell? And like he had his fingerprint on every inch of the magazine. But those were good memories when we got a chance to visit with him, for sure.
And waiting outside the door in Waco when the magazine comes out, that takes a little bit of dedication, because it's usually pretty hot.
That's right. It's hot this week for sure.
I know it was hot when we were there. It was in June, and it was welcome air conditioning when we got inside. Waco's a really cool museum town, not just the Texas Sports Hall of Fame, which the Southwest Conference Hall of Fame is part of. You've got the Dr. Pepper Museum there, which is really well done. The Texas Rangers Law Enforcement Hall of Fame is also in Waco. Kind of a fun time there stopping through the town. Jay, we appreciate you being on and telling us a little bit about the Southwest Conference Hall of Fame, and good luck next week as you get all the old-timers together.
Well, thank you very much, Matt. I appreciate the opportunity to share information about the museum.
Well, we appreciate your time. Jay Black of the Texas Sports Hall of Fame and the Southwest Conference Hall of Fame. We'll be back in just a moment after a word from Kendall King. Anthony Christensen will join me to talk about Razorback basketball.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over four decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design, with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are design.
One more segment until the weekend. Anthony Christensen of Whole Hog Sports is with us now to talk Razorback basketball. We're also going to talk about USA basketball, by the way. What a great game yesterday in Paris between the Americans and the Serbians. David Basil, by the way, I mentioned this yesterday. We thought we were going to have him on today. He had a scheduling conflict, couldn't come on today. We think we're going to get him on next week to talk about the Little Rock Touchdown Club and this great lineup that he's put together for 2024. So, Anthony, last week John Calipari met with reporters. It was the first time, other than like some of these little pit stops that he made in Little Rock, El Dorado, it was really the first press conference that he has had since he was hired at Arkansas. And so it's kind of interesting to get his thoughts on just how the spring and the summer have gone. What were some of the takeaways that you had from what he said?
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of the typical summer talk. I mean, everybody's excited. Everybody likes what they have in the summer. So, I mean, it really just kind of comes down to, you know, looking ahead and getting actual games going. And you know, obviously they mentioned that they're going to Dallas to play TCU in an exhibition. They're hoping to get Kansas at Bud Walton for another exhibition. So those will be the, I guess, the roadmaps to see exactly where this team, you know, actually is. But I mean, I think a lot of the press conference was, you know, built around, you know, Trevin Brazil, obviously the lone scholarship returner from, you know, Eric Musselman's last team. And there's a lot of hype surrounding him. I mean, he looked stronger. He looked confident just kind of talking about, you know, how the summer's gone for him personally after, you know, entering the draft and entering the transfer portal as well. But, you know, John Calipari said he's better than he thought he was, as did a couple of the newcomers and Boogie Fland and Adu Thierro. And yeah, a lot of it kind of revolved around Trevin Brazil and how he's looked. And, you know, obviously it's hard to, you know, sit here and say, you know, yeah, he has been looking good because we haven't, you know, haven't gotten to watch any of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe it was Matt Zimmerman on a podcast also said he's looked really good, like as good as he did pre ACL injury, which is, you know, it's a good sign if you're an Arkansas fan to be hearing that because of how, you know, even though I wasn't covering Arkansas at the time, he did look very good before his injury. So, and then there were other things as well. Obviously, it touched on John L. Davis and Adu Thierro and, you know, Jonas Adu and all those other guys. Calipari also said that Boogie Fland has looked better than he thought he would. And yeah, there's, you know, a lot of typical summer, fall talk, kind of happened on Monday.
This is 2 years in a row where Arkansas may play its most anticipated game in October. I mean, they played Purdue last year in an exhibition here in Fayetteville, and that was a lot of fun to be at. And now you can potentially have KU coming down for an exhibition game. And I've heard about this for a while, that this has been in the works. This is pretty cool, potentially. Not just the brands, but the coaches. Mm-hmm. You get Calipari and Bill Self, who seem to have quite a bit of admiration for one another.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, they've played against each other. I believe it was each of the last 5 years while Cal was at Kentucky. I might be wrong about that. I believe they're 500 against each other in head-to-heads.
Including in national championship games.
Yes, yep. Yeah. So, I mean, there does seem to be, you know, a good relationship between the two. I mean, I can't imagine they would keep playing against each other if there wasn't one. And obviously the brands come in together. I'm sure it would probably be a home-and-home exhibition exchange, so I'm sure Arkansas would probably end up going to Allen Fieldhouse at some point. Obviously, can't say that for sure, but that would be the assumption, right? So, I mean, the brands are, it's Kansas and it's Arkansas under John Calipari. So, I mean, it would be a lot of hype. It would be a lot of fun. People would, you know, get excited for it. And obviously, it'll only be an exhibition, so the game won't actually count for much, as we saw last mm-hmm. year with the Purdue exhibition, which was before my time. So I was aware of it, but didn't get to cover it. But it'd be interesting to see those two teams come up. Obviously, Kansas has, you know, one of the three best rosters on paper heading into the season, along with Alabama and UConn. So it'd be, you know, some high level basketball on display at Bud Walton.
How far behind do you think Arkansas is those three teams, just in terms of a talent perspective?
It's hard to say, just because obviously we don't know, you know, how this team's going to kind of come together and come kind of gel. From a talent standpoint, I mean, John L. Davis was the guy on a Final Four team, and there's not many teams in the country who can say they have, you know, a guy who's done that in the past. Maybe Alabama is the one that comes to mind because they've got Mark Sears back for his final year of eligibility. But other than that, it's kind of hard to, you know, pinpoint another team that still has, you know, that guy who kind of led the way for a Final Four. Because, I mean, DJ Burns has gone from NC State. UConn graduated and lost some guys to the NBA draft from last year. Purdue, obviously, Zach Edey ended up being a lottery pick. So, I mean, there's not a lot of, you know, those guys who have led their team to a Final Four. So John L. Davis obviously is a big time, you know, get for them and kind of has them, you know, talent wise, absolutely probably in that top 15 range. I've seen other people kind of put them, you know, in that same echelon as, you know, Alabama and, you know, those other teams, which I think might be a little premature, just because, I mean, we don't know how it's all going to come together and how kind of gel, but, you know, I think the talent is obviously there. Cause I mean, not only do you have, you know, John L. Davis and Adu Thiero, and I keep saying Adu Thiero, I was going to mention him along with the Kentucky transfers who've already played with each other. I meant to say Jonas Adu. Those guys coming in after being, you know, kind of two of the most sought after transfers in the country when they entered the portal. But, and then you also bring in your guys, you know, we're following Calipari from Kentucky. Adu Thiero, Zvonimir Ivicic, and DJ Wagner, as well as the freshman as well. So the talent is there. I'm just very intrigued to see how it all kind of comes together.
The schedule is kind of coming together. It's not quite finished, but this is kind of the typical. I wrote about this, I don't know, a month or two ago, about just I looked through all 15 years of how John Calipari scheduled at Kentucky, and really there was a pattern that emerged pretty quickly. It was that he doesn't like to do the big three-game, you know, multi-team events in Paradise. You know, doesn't quite like the Maui Invitational.
That's even a shame for us, isn't it?
Well, and it's kind of interesting to see what might happen because, you know, Arkansas is scheduled to go there again in 27. It'll be interesting to see if that actually stays on the schedule. But he had some things to say about the Maui Invitational last time Kentucky played in it. Basically, he didn't like what the travel did to his team in the days after they got back onto the mainland. But, you know, I was shocked to see that Kentucky never played in the battle for Atlantis. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of become, with Maui, one of the two big, you know, early season tournaments. What he seemed to like to do, neutral site games, lots of neutral site games, multi-team events that are, you know, basically just kind of made up MTEs, mm-hmm, on campus. We're going to see that, I think, little bit this year. It kind of falls into a pattern of what he's done. They're going to play in the Jimmy V Classic against Michigan at Madison Square Garden. Obviously, they're in the ACC-SEC Challenge. They'll play at Miami as part of this MTE. Here in Fayetteville, they've got an off-campus game. They'll play Illinois in Kansas City on Thanksgiving Day, I believe. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting schedule. I feel like maybe it's still Kansas is still the big deal for me. And TCU's not a bad game either, mm-hmm, if that ends up materializing there in Dallas. What are some other games that you've seen that stand out to you?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think the Oakland bye game is kind of a fun one, just because of the story behind, obviously, Oakland being the team that knocked Cal out of Kentucky, mm-hmm, as it kind of turned out to be. So that's an interesting one. Obviously, we don't have full schedule just yet. Just kind of waiting on some more stuff to come out, contracts and everything along those lines. But if we're looking at, you know, other games just from that perspective, I think the Oakland one is kind of the standout one, which you wouldn't typically say about Oakland, mm-hmm, just because obviously, you don't often get all that excited about a Horizon League bye game. It'll be a different Oakland team. Obviously, Jack Golke's graduated, Trey Townsend's gone to Arizona. So it'll be a different Oakland team, but that's obviously it's the team that knocked Calipari out of his last NCAA tournament with Kentucky. So I think that's the kind of the one that comes to mind when that's the question. And obviously I'm excited for the Illinois game because it's Kansas City, which isn't far from home for me. Mm-hmm. And then obviously a little bit of a reunion getting to cover Ben Humrichaus again, who transferred to Illinois from Evansville, which would be fun.
And Anthony came to us from Evansville, had no idea when we hired him earlier this year that he'd be covering a John Calipari coach basketball team in short order. SEC games, obviously, too. You kind of set those aside, mm-hmm, from what we're talking about non-conference games. You can pretty much circle every SEC game, and there's a unique element to it, whether it be Calipari against Kentucky, whether it be Calipari against some of these other coaches who he's got a relationship with, Jonas Adu against Tennessee, and you could go on and on down the, mm-hmm, list. We think that we'll get a finalized basketball schedule probably within about a month. That typically is when that happens. It was about early September every year, sometimes a little bit earlier, but I think we're still waiting on probably about two or three dates to be finalized before that's the case. All right, let's talk about the USA basketball game, because that's kind of that's what I'm looking forward to this weekend the most. They're going to play France in the gold medal game on Saturday afternoon. Is it 2:30 p.m. Central? I think it's the tip-off time.
I believe that is correct, yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know what the time change is. I think it's about 6 or 7 hours between the Central time zone and where they are in Paris. But this was an incredible basketball game yesterday between USA and Serbia.
Oh, it was one of, if not the best basketball game I've watched this year.
And I was going to say, I found myself more into this game than I think I've ever found myself in an international basketball game. And part of it is because I kind of know this is the end, or I think it's the end. You never know. I mean, maybe LeBron shocks us all and goes and plays in L.A. at the age of 43, it seems.
Yeah.
But, you know, you kind of just feel like this is kind of the end of an era for, you know, this generation of basketball players. Curry is ending. We talked about this with Joe Klein earlier this week. Curry's nearing the end. Durant's nearing the end. LeBron is nearing the end. I'll tell you what, in the fourth quarter yesterday, they looked ageless. And they looked just like they did probably 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah, and I mean, kind of touching on that, obviously, I mean, LeBron James has been playing professional basketball for quite literally as long as I can remember. I mean, it's so it is kind of making this Olympics a little bit more fun just to watch, just because it is kind of, on a personal level, I mean, the last run for those guys who I, you know, quite literally grew up watching. So that's been fun. But, I mean, that game was awesome. I mean, you come back from being down 17, and I mean, you've got those guys kind of playing, and then, I mean, don't forget to give Joel Embiid his flowers too. I mean, he's been a guy who's been, you know, criticized quite a lot, and I believe he finished 8 of 11 from the field and had, you know, a few really big defensive plays as well. But just kind of sticking on those guys, I mean, just kind of growing up with them, it's been a lot of fun. And then you also kind of see those kind of next generation guys kind of coming up as well. I mean, you got Devin Booker, who was phenomenal, especially in that fourth quarter. Everybody was phenomenal in the fourth quarter, but I mean, you got some of those younger guys kind of, you know, stepping up. Devin Booker, I believe, was on the last Olympic team that won gold as well in Tokyo. If I'm not mistaken, I could be. But I mean, it was just a phenomenal game of basketball.
You could see what Steve Kerr was doing, the USA coach, there at the end of the third quarter. It was an uphill climb pretty much the entire game, trying to get back. They were down 17, I think, early in the game. And then they get within 6 in the third quarter, and then he sits everybody for about the last 3-4 minutes of the quarter. And then Serbia goes on a run again, and they get up by, I think, 15 before the end of the third, and it's a 13-point game going into the fourth. But what he did was he sat those guys who he knew he was going to go to in the fourth quarter, and when the ball was inbounded in the fourth, there was a look in the eye of LeBron and Durant and Steph Curry that it was like, we're not losing this. It was kind of like, you know, you get into a basketball game and you're down in the fourth quarter and you think, well, who would I like, what would the dream people on the floor be for me? And I would say those three guys, those are all unicorns. You know, I mean, like, there's never been another player like a Durant, like a Curry, like a LeBron. There just has been. I mean, obviously, you can make comparisons between LeBron and, you know, whoever till the cows come home, but there's never been a player who's had the power and the versatility that I think he has. And you could even see the power late in the game yesterday. People point to his triple-double, but he was playing defense against Jokic for much of the fourth quarter, and Jokic was probably his worst quarter of basketball, at least in terms of that game. It was great. It was as a fun of an international game in any sport that I can remember watching. And I watch a few of them. I mean, I like international basketball, like USA soccer. I like watching USA hockey. I can't think of a game that was more entertaining than this one.
Yeah, I mean, I'm being a big soccer guy. I've got a few that I mean I can call back just from my whole life.
Landon Donovan against Algeria.
That one comes to mind. The U.S. 2009 Confederations Cup team that beat the Spain team that had, you know, been, I think, 30 games unbeaten or something like that. So, but I mean, you know, those come to mind. But, like, I mean, in terms of international basketball, this is probably the number one.
In basketball, USA usually is not challenged. Yeah. I know they've had some challenges this year, like the South Sudan game in the you know the run up to the Olympics. But usually, you watch USA basketball, and it's a close game might be 15 points a lot of times. And so to see them not only have to play a close game, but then really have to rally and do it, it was a lot of fun yesterday. And so now they'll play France in the gold medal game. The bronze medal game will be between Serbia and Germany. Both of these teams, the U.S. and the French, won by 4 points in the semifinals. And this, I think this is kind of the dream matchup that everybody wanted to see in the Olympics. It's a rematch of the gold medal game in Tokyo, and it's on French soil. And then you've got the Embiid element, the fact that he's kind of been public enemy number one because he could have played for the French national team, and he chose to play for the Americans. I got to believe that NBA is just, or NBC is just, you know, kind of licking its chops. Fact that they get this matchup on a weekend. I know I'm looking forward to it. The French, they've got Rudy Gobert. They've got Wembanyama from the Spurs. They've got some other Fournier, you know, some other, you know, good NBA players. Mm-hmm. But it almost feels like the Americans, that was their gold medal game yesterday. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe I'm underestimating what the French will bring to the table, but I just feel like you see this so many times that when you win that game that you probably should have lost, you're not losing the championship game.
Yeah, I mean, it I can see the I guess that feeling. I remember kind of feeling the same way when Gonzaga beat UCLA on the buzzer beater back in the bubble tournament, and then ended up getting blown out by Baylor. So
yeah.
I always take that with a little bit of a grain of salt, but I think I kind of turn back to the post game from yesterday. LeBron kind of getting the team, you know, huddled up, and he's just saying, "We got one more. We still got one more." So I mean, that was good to see. But I mean, this French team, I mean, they've got a lot of weapons, as you mentioned. You know, Rudy Gobert, who I believe, I could be wrong, has kind of struggled with injuries. So I mean, Lesor has kind of taken on a bigger role. They're very good inside. So, I mean, I think the U.S., you know, if they're going to win this game, is going to have to win, you know, on the perimeter, which is what Germany did when Germany beat France in the group stages. They lit them up from the perimeter. And obviously when you've got, you know, Steph Curry, you know, who was unbelievable yesterday, kind of taking those shots. I mean, I think that's a good thing for you, obviously.
Good to see Steph Curry do that one time, actually two times in person. Arkansas was playing in the NCAA tournament in 2008 in Raleigh, and also in that at that site was Davidson. Mm-hmm. And so in round one, Davidson was playing Gonzaga, and they beat him. I think Steph had 30 in that game. He either had 30 and 40 or 40 and 30. Mm-hmm. I can't remember which, but I remember he had those two numbers, and he had 70 points in that regional. But the game that really that stands out was they were playing Georgetown in the second round. And, you know, so the way the second round works is that there's only one session. So everybody's got a ticket for the session. You've got a ticket for two games. So you got all the Arkansas fans in there. All of the North Carolina fans are in there because they're getting ready to watch UNC Arkansas in the second round. And then the first round, or the second game of the day, but the first game of the day was Georgetown and Davidson. And Davidson got behind real big, like maybe 19 points. And Curry brought him back. He shot him back into that game. And it was so much fun because, you know, Davidson, Charlotte to Raleigh, a few hours. And then obviously you had a huge UNC contingent in there. But, you know, UNC and Georgetown, they've always kind of had this little thing where they don't like each other. And so the fact that you got this home state team playing a team that's kind of a pseudo rival. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the comeback. Boy, it was a lot of fun to watching Curry do that. And I remember thinking at that time, it's like, man, this is a really good college basketball player. I don't know that he'll ever be. You know, I don't know that. And
that was kind of the consensus on
there. And you got to give Mark Jackson and Steve Kerr a lot of credit, both of them, because they coached him at Golden State, for just kind of seeing the uniqueness of Curry, and really, you know, kind of allowing him to do his thing. And in the process, they've totally changed the game of basketball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, it's largely a 3-point centric game. I mean, you've kind of, I don't want to say eliminated the mid-range shot, but I mean, especially at least at the college level, I mean, it's threes and at the rim a lot. I mean, you've seen kind of mm-hmm. Josh Schertz, who just got the job at St. Louis. He kind of, I mean, he built Indiana State last year into arguably the best offensive team in the country by taking threes and shots at the rim and very little else. But I mean, yeah, Curry obviously has revolutionized the game and everything.
You know what the best news for the U.S. tomorrow is?
What's that?
The French don't have Jokic.
Yes.
You know, for people who don't watch a lot of NBA and they hear people say, oh, you know, Nikola Jokic is the best player in the world right now, I think if they don't watch the NBA, but maybe they tuned in for this USA-Serbia game or maybe the rerun because maybe they just heard about it and they got to see it in primetime last night, I think they know now why.
Oh, yeah.
Why he's the real deal.
I mean, his ability to just pass out of, you know, double teams and just find somebody who I don't even know if they knew they were open.
Yeah.
and just to find, like, I mean, he's just, I mean, to have that vision of passing as a big man, and I mean, his shooting and his rebounding, I mean, and he's not really an athlete. I'm not saying anything that's revolutionary here. Uh-huh. but I mean, his passing vision is arguably, I mean, just the most impressive thing about him, just because of the way he can work out of a double team. And if you double team him, he's gonna find the open man. But if you leave one guy on him, I mean, he's gonna beat them. So I mean, it's a pick your poison, really.
That's one of the things we're watching this weekend for sure, the USA gold medal game against France. We'll be back on Monday to talk more with you about Razorbacks. We'll have Christina or Ethan in here to talk about what they've seen from Razorback football practice over the weekend. We appreciate you being here, and we'll see you next time. Have a great weekend, everyone.